The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
Secure the template. Set the backside guide to appropriate locks and basket. The backside guide tabs include setting the jig, possessing template. What the hell am I reading?
It's time once again to be flabbergasted by the rolling tongue, the juggling of words, thoughts, and phrases, like a Spaniard on a tightrope. Here is the one, the only, the man of 2 hours, Frank Cottolo.
About a man who works in a nostalgia shop.
What the hell is a nostalgia shop?
A place where they sell old things, memorabilia, and... Does that sound terrible?
No subject is terrible if the story is true, if the prose is clean and honest, and if it affirms courage and grace under pressure.
You know, can I ask you the biggest favor in the world?
What is it?
Would you read it?
Your novel.
Yeah, it's like 400 pages long, and I'm just looking just for, you know, just an opinion.
My opinion is I hate it.
I mean, you haven't even read it.
If it's bad, I'll hate it because I hate bad writing. If it's good, I'll be envious and hate it all the more. You don't want the opinion of another writer.
Yeah, it's just, you know what it is? It's just, I'm having a hard time, you know, trusting somebody to evaluate it.
Writers are competitive.
I'm not going to be competitive with you.
You're too self-effacing. It's not manly. If you're a writer, declare yourself the best writer. But you're not as long as I'm around, unless you want to put the gloves on and settle it.
No, I don't.
Okay, I'm not going to read your novel, but I'll tell you what I'll do.
Yes?
I'll bring it to Gertrude Stein's. She's the only one I trust with my writing.
You'll show my novel to Gertrude Stein?
Give it to me.
I'll bring it to you.
She gets back from Spain tomorrow.
Great. I'm going to go get it. I can't tell you how excited I am. This is giving me such a lift that my heart is just racing right now. Okay, okay, I'm going to get it and then I'll be back.
Look out! Because here it comes.
I thought I saw it coming. I just had this ringing in my ears that said, here it comes. I know I hear it. I know it's on the way. Here it comes, and I'm telling you, in this event, in that event, and in all events, certainly in this event, what is it? I think it's this, wait, in that case, in this case, and in every case, coming up. Probably one of the more serious things I ever did in my life, without my pants. So come on, everyone, you will be there. And we will be there with you when you are there. What is it?
Cottolo Chronicles.
It's night. It's always night somewhere in the world. Right now, in your life, it's night. Now, I'm Frank Cottolo, the man whose name adorns the title of this show, Cottolo Chronicles. And if you're listening now, live, on the live stream, or if you're listening to it on the repeat stream, the point is this. I'm the only person who can get you through the next 2 hours. So hang on for dear life. I'm here. Special guest. Lots of talking about good stuff. So don't go away. Right, hang on. The third man. The godfather of internet radio. The bard of broadcasting. Tis I. Tis I. Tis I. I wonder sometimes if people do this all the time. I don't wonder sometimes if people do this, because people do this all the time. Nervous laughter. Bad jokes to respond to something you say because they just feel awkward. Because everyone feels awkward all the time, acting or not. Now, as for last week, do we even need to talk about it? Something was on. It was not me live. So the live stream had a recorded stream. Because once again, I'm not going to complain. I'm just going to report this. Once again, tech breakdown. I don't know why these things happen. I never did. I do know that in Y2K plus 18, we've had more technical problems and more cancellations due to zeros and ones deciding that they don't want to be in their correct order than almost any, and we're doing that Brooklyn thing, right? Than any other year. I mean, when we had worse equipment, we had less breakdowns. So things are getting complicated, more complex, and you gotta wake up, it's night. I'm still the bard of broadcasting. I am here. This is a live stream if you're listening on a Thursday night. And I'm here on the last day of May. If you're listening on the Lifelike, that is another station that is running it, or you're listening on the Juice Talk Archive Playmobil or whatever that is, listening live and streaming it yourself or downloading it, whatever you're doing, we are here. And we're going to have, on the last day of May, that's the live stream, of course, we're going to have an old friend of this show and a participant in the great arts that men like him and I, and women like him and I, him and I, him and I, it sounds like a place, doesn't it? I've been to him and I'm back. Mr. Charles Dennis will be here. We're going to be talking about his book, Hollywood Raj, R-A-J. If you read the promos, if you read the blog. You know, on the blog, it says that something went on last week. Even though on Facebook I said we had to cancel, but there was a rerun. The blog has something I'm going to reiterate. The thing about the 90 comedy books that you must read, we're going to go through that when we don't have a guest. When I'm here, we'll go through the list. I'll talk to you, having read some, having not read some, and I'll give you some advice. And then you can take it or not take it. 90 books? How are there 90 comedy books you should read? I don't know. But along the way, like, hey, you know, I'll tell you what happened. I have the boom mic stand. Because the little mic stand has been traveling from here to all over the country and all over the world, because it went to Canada. It went to my son, who has a show, has been traveling around upstate New York, Ohio. Did he go to Ohio yet? I don't know. They're going to Minnesota. They're all over the place. They're in Canada, as I said. So he takes that mic stand with him. Should have gotten him one for his birthday. They didn't know he was going to do so much traveling. I have always done this show from right here. I've never taken this show on the road. I've gone on the road for various other situations, but not to do this show live. Maybe before the show is over per se with me, I should do it. But anyway, let's move on, because there's plenty of stuff to talk about tonight, and it is night. Wake up. It's night. It's the reason I played in the collage of the opening a little section from Midnight in Paris, where a writer happens to go back in time and meet Ernest Hemingway and asks him to read his novel. not Hemingway's novel. The writer asks Hemingway to read a novel. And Hemingway's advice about, I'm a writer, you're a writer, we're competitive, I don't like it. If I read it, I like it, I don't like it, whatever. So he just says he hates it right away. Writers reading writers and writers talking about writing is a very strange thing, because writing is such a lonely endeavor. But when a writer talks to a writer, and the writer has written alone, and I've written alone, and so whatever. So anyway, being the author of books myself, and Charles Dennis, of course, has written books, although he's also directed movies. I would never direct a movie. I hate the idea of directing. I've done some TV, and I hate it. So that's okay. But I'm not a director. I'm a word man. And as you can hear right there, a man of love. You can't be a man of few words if you're going to write novels, but I've written novellas. And the book that we're going to be talking about, Hollywood Raj, which you could get on Amazon, just like you can get my books. And we're going to talk more about that. Charles and his publisher will be here moments from now. So that was the tech break. That's why I tried to find something that would fit into the fact that two writers will be talking about writing. And there's a story behind the book, and he'll tell you everything. I've only read part of it, and I'm not here to review it, you say. I'm here to talk about it to Charles, with Charles, and have him explain it, and get you interested so you can buy it. Just like I ask you to buy my books, you can buy his book. And all the books that you want to buy. Because now, if you go out to buy books, you don't go out, first of all. You go to Amazon. Not the Amazon. Imagine if you had to go to the only place you can get books is at the Amazon. And no, you're not. We're not going there. You go to Amazon and put in the name of any author. Chances are, and good chances are, their books are available in digital form. Now, I have books other places. Because they conflict with, you can't have books on two different places and published different ways or what have you. So I encourage you again to go to blurb.com for my Molotov Memoirs duo, or to Lulu for the more simpler little chapbook type things. But what I mentioned was, you go to Amazon and you can get so much for so little. I mean, by comparison, if you go to a bookstore, and this is why bookstores are hurting. You know, there was book binders, book masters, book busters, whatever there was. There were tons of them. Now there's not. Now they have to be consortiums. The book place also has to sell CDs, and it has to sell toys, and it has to sell cards and whatever's left of magazines. And check this out. I think you might know this because you're hip. It has to sell records, wax records. That's right. Record albums. You know, you need a needle and a machine to do it. And some of them sell the little machines. Analog is back. It never left this show, because this show, although it depends upon digital technology to get out there, it is a analog connection to the, you know, it's not, in other words, it's not a program on, it's not an app or a program that does the shooting out the noise. It doesn't do that. So you can get lots of books there too. And we'll talk more about that when he gets here. I think there are other stuff too. I told you The Artist D is coming back. That's going to happen. Here's Charles Dennis. That's it. I have a little list here that I kept. we'll hopefully have some cool stuff coming up, even though it's getting hot again. I could feel it. Summer's here, and that means we just melt and sweat and lose weight, which we're trying to do anyway, and doing a great job, I might add, if you're interested. If you're not, you heard it anyway. The Artist D will be here soon. I mean, maybe next, in June, because June is what's coming up. And The Artist D, who, of course, is on For Culture, For Thought on Tuesdays, and my son, who takes the mic stand all over the place, is also on that panel and with other people. And Tuesday nights on YouTube, so live on YouTube. Wow, live on YouTube. And, you know, it's amazing. We do this, everybody does, forget it. Why even talk about that in that sense? Seven will be back. Seven Graylins. One of the original talkers on internet broadcasting from the ampcast.com days. And, you know, one of these days, and I going to have to get the kids out of the room, I'm going to run, I get these weird sounds, you know, I'm going to run this old tape. See, I said that. See how connected I am to my past? I'm going to run this recording. I just call it a recording of this funny, but rather blue section from, you know, it's like there's this bee or something around. It is. Oh no, it's one of those stink bugs. You know, I'm going to tell the story of the bee one of these days. The pterodactyl bee that I killed the other day. I hunted, and I'm a little worried that there might be some more bees. And then someone tells me, you know, you want to get me neurotic. Someone tells me, oh my goodness, it was a big, weird looking bee, very large. Yeah, and it looks like a bee, but it's a wasp, and it has fluttering, angel wings. Oh, yeah. He said, oh, those things are stinging people somewhere in what? In the West? There are these hordes of bees. I guess they're killer bees, and then they're not just killing people. They're crippling them and doing all sorts of stuff. These stink bugs don't do anything. You know, bugs that, I gotta let him alone for a while. You know, they get over here just the way they did in that movie, Anachronia. You know the one about the spiders where it just happens to get into a box that's shipped to America, and next thing you know, there's deadly spiders all over the place. But anyway, I'll tell that story some other time because Charles Dennis is coming in. Seven Graylins is gonna be here. I don't know, but he's going to be back. He's a real internet pusher. He's a guy who knows exactly what to do, how to market and stuff. He's been in it a long time. He's not one of those people who showed up in the beginning when nobody knew, but there were people who said they did know. Not going to happen. And Ben Knoll, you're going to love this guy. He was on once before a long time ago with, Jeremy Long was here and he was here. Ben Knoll. He's going to be on again. Tell us what he's doing. He has a book or two out, and he's a funny guy, and I like funny guys. And I'm, oh my goodness, I've already taken the few sheets I have, and I'm starting to fan myself. This is not good. Not good, because when it gets hot down here, it gets hot. But in any event, in all events, and certainly in this event, that's happening. Three Amigos will be here. Tom Martin. Not Steve Martin, but Tom Martin, closest thing to Steve Martin you'd ever want to hear, and Tom Savino, who does the Savino Veritas show on SRN, and who is an old friend of mine. And I'm also going to be telling you about some new stuff that was released that Tom has saved. Tom Savino used to be my partner in radio many, many years ago when none of this existed. And he's found and somehow restored some great old tapes. Wild stuff that was done, I mean, you know, a long time ago. We're talking 70s here, friends. Oh, boy. And we're going to be playing some of that. Tell you where to go to get that. But, you know, as far as Tom is concerned, I am concerned. The Artist D is concerned. These are three people you can find on juicedtalk.com, which is a website where you can stream or download various shows archived from the series. And there's other shows on there too, I believe, from the past and shows that haven't been on. Is Velvet Steel still there? I don't know. But we've gone through so many incarnations and we have so many friends who have done stuff here that thanks to the Artist D, who maintains this stuff and does about 16 shows himself, you know. Is he doing 16 shows now? Is All Might still going? You know, I said, like, Frank, you know, you should know this stuff. These are your comrades. These are the people you deal with and work with all this time. I know, but I don't have time. I know I don't have time for myself. And that is another story and something you don't need to know, because it's eventually going to eat up all my time. And we'll deal with that when we get there. There are things I cannot tell you about and won't, but they continue to move along as I am here on Cthulhu Chronicles. I'm going to go get Charles Dennis, who's a great talker and is going to talk with you and I about so many things, including this book. The book is called The Hollywood Raj. It's R-A-J. And I'm going to ask him stuff as if I know nothing, because you know nothing, and that's how I like to deal with this stuff when it comes to books. You know that if you've listened to this show ever. If you haven't, you're listening for the first time. Remember, I'm the only person, if you're listening, who can get you through the next 2 hours, if you are listening. And Charles Dennis is going to help me, thanks to Skype. Hope. Oh, got to wait a second now, because there's a stink bug. How do stink bugs fly? And yet, not long. And when they fly, they look like something else. I mean, you know, they don't look like a drawbridge. They look like something else, like another insect flying. And they're dumb, and we wouldn't have them here in America if they didn't get shipped here in various forms of cargo, I believe from China. I think China always had stink bugs. Why are they called stink bugs? Take a guess. It's not difficult, and it's not a scientific term. Somebody put one of these things to their nose and said, "Oh my goodness, they stink." Here comes this is Charles Dennis. This is Charles Dennis right here. Hello? Huh? You're not going to see me. I'm going to see you though, since you're on. It's okay.
This is a fucking miracle because.
Why?
Hello.
There's
Hi.
Ulrika.
Oh, how you doing, Ulrika? How are you?
You?
I'm here. What is a miracle about this?
Well, because I got a new iMac back in January, and I guess I haven't Skyped anybody, so there was no Skype in there, and then I tried to get on. Anyhow, here we are.
I hear, and I've always been a PC guy. You know, there's been a fight since the beginning. I'm a PC guy, I'm a Mac guy, I'm an Apple guy, you know? And you've done all your stuff with the Mac and Apple, right? Haven't you? Even your movies?
In the last 10 years, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm learning that people who are using the stuff you're using are getting having a lot less problems with the digital platform. So,
oh, good.
Yeah. So if you got a new, and I don't know what model, I don't know. Tell everybody, people who listen to this know this stuff. What'd you get? What did you get? Did you get them?
I got an iMac. I was working on the iPad, but Ulrika had this big iMac, and I thought it would be, you know, we have a partner's desk, so we work across from each other. So I thought it would be better to have the same stuff.
It's a wonderful picture. Is it coming through? Is it in built-in microphone and camera?
This is on the iPad.
This is just the iPad.
It's like better than the, I have to connect one and it screws up everything. So you're in good shape with a new iMac.
Yeah, well, years ago, I house sat, for Richard Benjamin and Paula. They were going to New York to do a play and I was looking for, I didn't have a house at the time and I just relocated from back east. And it worked out perfectly. They were gone for 3 months, and I lived there. And my whatever it was, non-Mac, I don't remember the name anymore, but it broke. And I had to send it back east to be refurbished. And they were Apple people. And I had always, I drunk the Kool-Aid. You know, the Microsoft people said, well, this stuff is, you know, it's always breaks down, and it's never going to, they're going to go out of business. And I turned it on and I said, oh my God, this is for every moron who ever lived. It just does, it guides you through it. And that was it. That was the beginning of my conversion.
Well, people in our generation grew up, when we started computers, all started with Macintosh and Apple. Very few of us started with PCs because they had all the original formats and the, you know, files and things that they stole from them. I guess it's stealing. Anyway, this is Tech Talk. Tech Talk with Charles Dennis and Ulrika. How are you, Ulrika? I'm glad that you're on the show this time, because a few times Charles was on with either alone or with other people, and you're in the background saying hi and this, that, and the other thing. And you're an important cog in this machine, as I know. And you know you're busy, and so you didn't have enough time to stop and take time with us, and I'm glad you're here.
Great. I'm glad to be here, and you know, it'll be extra fun on this podcast to you know, to talk about new projects, but also, you know, my part is to bring in the financial side of it, the business side, and then, you know, basically share with you and your audience, you know, Food Dog Films and basically reinventing and the new vision and how, you know, we are now approaching, you know, creating new material and, you know, overcoming the obstacles, and basically, you know, being, you know, pioneers in, you know, looking for new opportunities in an existing business model with a lot of very nasty barriers to entry and, you know, now being able to basically find a new way and, you know, looking at things and, you know, how you get things out to audiences, everything from, you know, content creation to the production, to the post-production, to the distribution. So, you know, it's a whole new thing and, you know, we're very excited. And we have a lot of great products and projects, and you know, specifically these two we will discuss with you tonight.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when this show began, and we began like the first week that there was broadband, because you couldn't do this with the old modems and stuff. It was just too complicated.
What year was that?
Yeah, huh?
What year was that?
That was 99 or 98. I think we started.
Wow.
Yeah, and this was like the first, you know, weekly talk show. But, and I had said then, I said, hey, that, we knew that new things were going to open up at the time. We didn't know that you could do movies and do everything you do today, but we knew progress was really speeding along. And I had said something back then, and it's extra true now. And you know this, you'll know this too. I said, you know, the best thing about this whole new platform, this whole theater of the internet and digital, technology is that anybody can have a website, can get on, get exposure, and present themselves, okay? Now, the worst thing about this internet and digital platform is that everybody and anybody can get
on. Yeah,
exactly. And now, now that it is so, it's so wealthy with media availability, my son can, you know, get onto whatever it is, Windows Movie Maker or whatever it is, and does things that we never even thought of doing. I mean, I tried, you know, 8mm stuff back in the, you know, 60s and, you know, all that stuff. We dealing in the world of analog, we were weighed down, and now everybody does it. So this is one of the things we really do need to talk about, Erika, and that is that, you know, it's so busy. There's so much traffic out there, and you've got to get some kind of pathway and some really neat ways of exposing it to audiences, because everything is so. The audiences are helter skelter. There is no way, believe me, to get demographics. I know this because we've been doing this from the beginning, and there's no way. And it took a long time for, you know, the commercial world, not just to come on and accept this platform, but to realize that they're going to have to measure things an entirely different way. I think I just said exactly what you said, but
yeah.
But in another way.
Right. Yeah. Also, a challenge, but you know, it's a challenge, but also an opportunity. And this is something that I talk about, you know, with other clients that I have. And that is that the consumer is becoming very educated, very mm-hmm. smart, and very price sensitive. So, you know, because there's information everywhere. So whatever you sell, be it a service or, you know, a product, everything is, in my opinion, treated as a commodity, because there are so many ways to check the price, and very similar things are offered at so many different, you know, distribution channels. And, you know, unless it's something very unique, and unless it's like, you know, in fashion, something very, you know, trendy and you have to have it now, you know, consumers know to shop around, and consumers are very educated. They're well qualified, and they're very discriminating buyers. And, you know, that has pros and that has cons. And it's very important for everyone to be aware of that and to basically adapt their business model accordingly. And, you know, what do you do to minimize your threat, and what do you do to expand on your opportunity? So it's a whole new world. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like, you know, barriers to entry are being removed. And, you know, it's like everyone can just jump in. But then again, there's a supply and demand. So if someone jumps in and it's not valuable, well, then they fall off. But, you know, the marketplace is just, you know, it's unlimited. There's like, you know, everyone is a go.
And she's so right. And you're so right.
It's scary and good, both at the same time.
It's the Wild West, you know.
Oh, boy. Sometimes it's just too much. Having been here through it, through all the development of everything, and actually doing something, it's a whole other story. But anyway, let's get to the other story. Let's get to Hollywood Raj and then, talk about these various things through it because it's a product and it has a little history to it. I really like the backstory.
The thing about Charles Bennett?
Yes, the thing about Charles Bennett and some other great names. Now, the only thing I'm going to say is, now and then, we have to understand that there's a lot of younger people here. When I was reading through that, and of course, when I was reading through, the chapters you sent me, you have the same problem I have, and that is that there are younger people who, when you drop names, and even great names, names that you and I know are great names, and are historic in the, you know, through the years of golden Hollywood and Hollywood or what have you. You have to understand that people still don't know. There are a lot of kids, and I say kids because let's face it, they're kids who don't know. Yeah. The other night, my son, who tonight is at an open mic doing comedy because something else he wants to do and, you know, let him do it, right? So, but, he said to me the other night, he says, I was watching an old Carson show. Carson, who we wouldn't know unless I told him about it and know that these reruns are all on the air now. And he said, I saw this strangest guy. He's doing a routine. He said, did you ever hear the name Red Buttons? You know, like, yeah, you know, here we go again. You know, I could, you know, and, so you're, there are people I know who would be reading the book. And stop, and you know, what are you going to do? You can't write a book, can't stop and then put a bio into, you know, for a certain audience. But Charles, when you're writing a book like this and you're blending fiction with a history, there are a lot of people who will go, oh, so this happened. And in other words, how do they draw the line between history and fiction?
Well, there's two approaches to this. Number one is they're reading a novel. So if they don't know who Ronald Coleman or Basil Rathbone were, they may think these are names I made up.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just characters in the book. So that way I don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, a friend of mine, Martha Henry, was like the greatest actress in Canada. I sent her an earlier version of it. And she wanted to know if she's been around the block, but she wanted to know if the Radfords were real and why she wasn't aware of them before. Hmm. So, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's a compliment in a way to the writing that I've made them so real. And I don't think it really matters. I mean, one of the thoughts, I mean, down the road, you know, like the annotated Alice in Wonderland, where, you know, there's a little number and you go down the bottom of the page and then itty bitty type, it says who these people were. If they want to, but otherwise, I think you don't need to be a film historian to appreciate the book because it's a good story.
I agree with that. The thing is that when you're mixing history with fiction, generation, we're dealing with Generation Z now. You know, I mean, we're beyond the millennials now, and this is one weird bunch of people in terms of an audience. They discern a little bit. I just wonder, you're right. I'm not saying you're wrong. That's a good way to look at it. I told people for a couple of years now, because I knew I was getting a younger audience, to keep a little notebook on the side. And when we drop names or what have you, write them down and then go to go to Google or go what, and then later on, look up these things within the, and you'll understand a lot of stuff we're talking about because you can't stop and tell everyone everything. So you're right. All right. So barring that, when was it, wasn't this done? This was finished and on the market, what, already a while ago, wasn't it? I thought I saw this book available. How long now?
Book was published on Valentine's Day.
Okay. That's February. That's
yeah.
Okay. Fine. And
that's this year. Yes, or are we now doing month to month as a new generation? I can't keep up, Frank.
What? You can't keep up? What number book is this of yours, then?
This is Lucky 13.
Wow, 13. 13 books.
And the Vingsbo Press were the publishers, and of course I'm sitting next to the publisher here.
Spell it. Spell it for people. You just said.
V as in Victor, yeah. I as in India, N as in Norman, G as in Golly, S as in Sugar, P as in Boy, O as in O.
Okay, do you get that down, people? You're writing it down in your notebook? Okay.
Just go to Amazon. There it is. You can get it on Kindle.
Yes.
Or you can get a copy that you can hold in your hands.
I was telling people, as I do all the time, because I'm trying to, hawk my crap on there, too. And not that yours is crap. You know what I mean. I'm just talking.
I understand. We're talking streets, bro.
Yeah, we're city folk. We're kids from the street. Yeah. So you know what I'm saying. And that is that if you go to get some of these digital books, you could spend, I don't know the comparison. I just know that for like $30, you can get all my books. And if they were anywhere, and some of them are still available here and there, but if you had to buy this analog stuff, what would that cost you these days? Have you seen the cost of books in what's left of bookstores?
Are they like 30 bucks?
Yeah. But you have there are analog versions, aren't there, Ulrika? Aren't there?
You mean hold it in your hand copies?
It's still a market that's been changing a lot, and it's they're like the people, if you have the spectrum, so they're the people who absolutely will not hold a book and read. And then there are people who only will hold a book and read. And then they're all in between. And again, it goes back to my earlier comment about, consumers being price sensitive. So, what matters to you? Does it matter? Would you pay extra to have the copy in your hand? Or do you just want to have the cheapest price and read it? I mean, I'm totally old school when it comes to books. It's like, I cannot read anything online. I have to have the book. I have to feel the pages. It's like a reading experience. And that's how I grew up. So. But it's a different market and I really do think that, the different types of readers and customers, there's a different experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
When you hold a book and you kind of, you see it in your head and, you kind of visualize the characters as you read that very much is, exactly the point where, markets are changing and customers and, what they want, what experience do they want. But I think Hollywood Rush is a book that really, is for someone to hold and read and feel the pages, and you can go back and, that kind of reading experience.
And the other thing about the market also is digital. The digital world has invaded or helped and corrupted. Let's just say corrupted many industries, and the printing industry has changed so much since it started also. So there aren't the printers out there aren't out there in the numbers they were. And I'm sure it's much more expensive to print now than it ever was, right?
Well, yeah, but also, this outsourcing, which everyone goes nuts about, outsourcing in publishing was going on 30, 40 years ago. Anytime you saw a beautiful coffee table book, if you looked at the back, you saw it was printed in Singapore.
Mm.
And this is back in the 80s.
Sure.
Because even then it was just too expensive. And that company Abrams, who seems to have done all those huge, gorgeous books. But I never ever saw one of those Abrams books that was ever at its original retail price. They were always instantly marked down 50%. So I don't know what that was all about.
And then there's a print to order that's old too, but now it's a lot more freely offered. They only print them when they're ordered.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that goes into movies as well. They discovered Warner Brothers or whomever discovered they couldn't really do 5,000 copies of Four Daughters with John Garfield because there just wasn't enough business. So they came up with this video on demand, where they would press the thing and send it to you.
Isn't it incredible how there's brand new movies, and this still all has to do with trying to get the money and the royalties and all the things that used to come to artists and performers and writers or whatever. But, you know, you get, there's like $29.95. You go, they're just released, $29.95. I don't know the difference between Blu-ray and regular, but the point is the movie's out there, right? And then in the same store, and I'll tell you the store, I'm talking about Best Buy. Best Buy have these bins, okay?
Yeah.
And in the bins, you get like, you go, you go, hey, wait, this was like $30 3 months ago, and now it's $5.99. And they're still making an incredible profit of it, because it just does not cost that much to make those things as it did. Well, it didn't do anything. I don't know, even tapes. Before tapes, there was nothing. Nobody bought, very few people bought, you know, six real movies and brought them home. There wasn't a commercial market, at least, right?
Where are all the 8-tracks? What did they do with them?
Oh, God. I never liked them anyway.
They were horrible, but I mean,
yeah.
What, you know, it's like all the television sets have got dumped into some river in South China and they're killing everybody.
Right, right.
For the radiation. But we ship them over there. It's fascinating. I remember my friend Sid Gannis when he was the VP at Sony. And, you know, you had to put, I guess it started back in the 70s with Jaws, where you just opened the picture at 2,000 screens. It was the idea of platforming had ceased to exist. So you opened a picture with 2,000 screens, which meant 2,000 prints.
Yeah.
And that picture bombed on the weekend. That was it.
Yeah.
1,000 prints. Now, back then, I think a print was something like $2,000 a print. So 2,000 times 2,000.
Yeah.
You know, what are we looking at? 400,000 or four? I get whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to Sid, so what can you do with those prints? He said nothing.
Nothing.
Guitar picks is about the only
guitar
thing.
Guitar picks.
Well, it's true. Yeah. But I mean, my God, what a huge waste of everything.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that the streamlining element of digital production on every level is, you know.
Well, and the great thing about it, at least, you know, you're not wasting, you know, all that money and all that product, which has to be dumped somewhere. Now you've got digital. I remember when there was a period about 20 years ago, and it was around the beginning of broadband, because I was the VP of new business for this video company.
Uh-huh.
And I would go every year to this big event in Pasadena. And I remember it was 1999, and they had this thing called broadband, which I was trying desperately to comprehend. You know, they would show you what looked like the inside of a human body, and there were all these pipes and things.
Right.
And of course, now we take broadband for granted.
Sure.
But as you say, that was almost 30 years ago now, 20, and it's just, you know, it's staggering. But back then, I was trying to come up with, they had a satellite, this company, and I thought, what can we do with that satellite that would get a lot of attention? And back then, John Wayne's company, Batjack, had a couple of movies that for various reasons had not been shown publicly for 30 years. And one of them was The High and the Mighty, which I cut. So I got this great idea, which was to show The High and the Mighty in theaters that had digital, back then there weren't a lot of digital projectors. Now it's only digital projectors, but to beam the movie from space into the theaters.
Wow. That's, you know who did that? That's been done with some music concerts early on.
Oh, it was somebody having got this, and I'm not a genius.
It makes sense.
And plus, there'd be no pirate. That's the one thing about this broadcasting from space. There's no piracy.
And China existed at the time.
Yeah. Well, because the thing with the piracy that I always found amazing was that, you know, projectionists would be in on this. So as soon as the first, you know, people probably aren't aware of this now, especially the younger generation, but a reel of a movie was maybe 20 minutes. So how many, well, that's what they had, two reels. They were 10 minutes. So you were changing the reels to put on the next one. As soon as the first reel was done, a guy was there with a motorcycle who took that reel, zapped it off to some lab somewhere where they copied it. Mm-hmm. And then it got back. By the end of the movies being shown, everything was back and was sent back to Paramount or Warner's, whatever. But by then, the you know, the bootleg copies had been made.
Wow. Yeah.
And then later on, people, and what's amazing, people buy them. People would go into the movie theaters with their own little video camera.
Yeah,
and they would
heard
just
that.
Tape the movie that was on the screen.
It's a lot more sophisticated than that now. I don't know what the new generation, Generation Z, I don't know what they're doing, but it is being handed down. It's a legacy, at least comes from the millennials. There wasn't one millennial I met during any number of research things I was doing or friends I had who did not know how to download a film that you can't download, so to speak. All right. All knew exactly what to do, where to go, and how to get it. That's the great impact of being raised with this information highway, which was all about sharing and not about buying, as we know. And that's been the main commercial problem of it throughout. But if you're growing up in this world and you've gotten everything for free, the idea of buying it is you can either be incredibly cheap and you're too busy to download it, because everyone knows how to go and get whatever it is you want to get for nothing.
Well, that's what killed the music industry.
That's one of the things I'm talking about. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. More the movies. Cause it's easier just to do sound than to do picture and sound because it takes up.
Yeah,
more
but
chip.
That's true. But then now they've got machines that are bigger. You've got people who have extra hard disks all over the place, and you have, the speed that this stuff can maintain while it's downloading makes it not so difficult anymore to get illegal films and stuff and things like that. I found one of my books was bootlegged. I found it on some other site somewhere. I forgot exactly how it happened. And I went like, oh, come on. It's like, if you're going to bootleg somebody, bootleg somebody know, a lot of people know. Don't book, what am I doing? Why are they bootlegging? I get nothing for these. Although
bootleg John Grisham, he can afford it.
Yeah, what's with the Stephen King? Every time I go to the store, it's another 1,700 page book. It's like, there aren't that many verbs. Anyway, let's get back to.
I just love the idea of some village in Tibet. And you go there, some guy in the street selling Cthulhu books.
Right, Amy, right. I was big in Japan at one time. All us flops get big in Japan. Why? Because the stuff is free. Thank you very much. Let's talk about Hollywood Raj again, because I'm always interested as a writer, where it comes, where do ideas come from, or how do you get so involved in something as to produce, 80 to 90 to 100,000 words, of a complex story, a lot more complex than it is, as a screenplay. But as I read when you talked about it, trying to be a series, or working it as, trying to work it as a series in a, TV series or cable, whatever it was at that particular time. But let's go back.
That was about 4 years ago.
So I'm going to go back and explain.
Back to Charles Bennett, because he really was the inspiration. When I first moved out here in the 70s, and I was at an event at the LA Academy Museum of Art. It was about British cinema, and I was there and having cocktails, and I heard this wonderful voice, it was just one of those great classic British, and I thought, who's this? And I looked around, there's this little guy, he was only about 5'2", 5'3", and he was probably 70 then, and the old 70 as I call it.
Yeah.
Now. And I said, who's that? Is this someone I've forgotten from the movies who's still, this was Charles Bennett, and he was talking with Anna Lee, who movie buffs would remember from all the John Ford movies, How Green Was My Valley, etc. Mm-hmm. And we got to chatting, and he was a riot, and he was charming, and we became friends. And then I didn't see Charles for about 10 years, and this very strange guy named Jones Harris, who was the son of Ruth Gordon and Jed Harris, the director. And he was sort of the bastard of Broadway because Jed Harris was screwing everybody in the business. And Ruth Gordon was hopelessly in love with him and figured, well, if I get pregnant, he'll have to marry me.
Hmm.
And so she got pregnant and she told Jed Harris, he said, mazel tov. You know? And so she went to Paris and had the baby, as women did back then who didn't want to go to backstreet abortionists. And so he grew up in this very strange, he was, everyone knew whose child he was, etc. But his name was, Jones was Ruth Gordon's real name, with Ruth Jones, and that's how his name came to be. Anyhow, he got in touch with me through a friend of mine named Ted Hardwick, whose father was Sir Cedric Hardwick.
Ah.
And he had this idea for a play that he thought I should write about an English expatriate actor in Hollywood during the war. So I thought, I should go talk to Charles Bennett about this, and feel him out. And somewhere in the course of our conversation, Charles very offhandedly mentioned that he was the Secret Service's man in Hollywood. I said, what? He said, I was a spy. I was a spy. And he blew me away. And he told me about what he did and who he thought was a spy and who wasn't. And I thought, my God, this is fantastic. And Charles died. He was 90 or something. And the idea never left me. And I met somebody from Vanity Fair, and I pitched them the story, because they're always doing old Hollywood stories. And they never got back to me. I start, and I thought, well, what if it wasn't a writer? What if it was an actor of a certain age? It was 50, and suddenly his career had stalled. There was nowhere for him to go. And this friend of his, who had been his buddy in the First World War, who's now with MI5 at the Secret Service, drafts him into service as a spy for the British in Hollywood. And that's how it came to be.
Well, what you didn't know, and I'm a little confused about this too, why would the British have spies? This is before the war. This is before the war, because when it starts off, there's no war when Joe Kennedy.
I know. Right? There was the whole, Churchill had a shadow government, that he had been sidelined. Nobody wanted to listen to Churchill. Chamberlain wanted appeasement with Hitler while Hitler was gobbling up stuff. And there was the conscious awareness of people that, there's going to be a war sooner than later.
It's a spy thing, but what?
And whether America likes it or not, it's going to be involved. Now, America managed to go 2 years without being in the war.
Right.
But because of that, it became a hotbed here of people who were, it's hard to believe now, but there were people in America who were sympathetic to Hitler.
Oh, the Bund, right? The Bund. Did I say that?
Hello, Charles Lindbergh.
Yes, there were.
And
that's
Kennedy, mm-hmm. who kept, who was all gung-ho about, we can make peace with this guy. So there was all kinds of activity going on. The Japanese, of course, were busy spying on all the naval installations along the Pacific, mm-hmm. California coast, because if they were going to invade, they wanted to know, where the United States was vulnerable. So this was all stuff, people go to war sometimes years before they go to war.
Sure.
And that's what the world of espionage is all about, is seeing what the vulnerability of a country is, seeing who you can get to be on your side if they go in. And this was always fascinating to me. And the research on this, discovering, a large number of people who were in the film industry and in the theater, Noel Coward was a spy for the British, all sorts of people. Alexander Korda, who was a Hungarian who became British, but his offices were being used by the Secret Service as a place to have an office.
Yeah, what about the war or the coming of war? What about that era really gets you? Let me ask you this question, man. What did you, because I only read three chapters, what did you discover was so compelling to you about the British being in Hollywood spying. I mean, what'd they do? What did they do? It's not saying Basil Rathbone was a spy. What do you do? Report back to MI5?
Well, Charles Bates.
Hey, you know, they're really ruining these books. We're really ruining these stories. What is it?
Charles Bennett's job was to just nose around within the industry and around the town itself and report back to London, about what was going on. I mean, Vermont Avenue, which is over in the east side of London.
I remember. Yeah.
Every other shop, and even still now, you know, German bakeries, German this, German that. So the Bund, you know, had a very sympathetic German-American support.
So a lot of these movies that we've seen, like the one with there was recently saw one I never saw before with the Humphrey Bogart. I forgot what it was. These ones about, you know, the Nazis. This is before the war. There were all these all these movies they made where the Nazis were the bad guys.
Oh, All Through the Night? Is that the one?
Yeah, maybe it is. Yeah, yeah, maybe that was it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Conrad Veidt and Peter Lorre Of course, what's fascinating is all these parts of Nazis were played by Jews who fled the Nazis. Or else.
Well, they're actors, you know, actors.
His wife was Jewish and he couldn't stand the Nazis.
But so all this stuff came from there. To me, it's like I don't know what on earth they would tell. What would be so interesting if inside of Hollywood, because there wasn't, were there Bunds people and were there Germans in there, or were they looking for German spies while they were making movies or what?
Here's the fascinating things that's there in the first book.
There's a wind blowing, Watson. Remember that?
Exactly.
And then they made Sherlock. Remember they brought him up. They forget about being the 1800s. So let's have him fight the Nazis. Remember that movie, The Secret Weapon?
Everyone was fighting the Nazis.
Timeless.
Because all through the 19th, from the minute Hitler came to power in Germany, this is not the amazing thing. The second largest market in the world for American films was Germany. More than England, more than anywhere else, the German market was huge.
Before I read any word in your book, I had heard somewhere else, and maybe it was on this, you know, they had the American AHM, was that the American Hitler Channel now they have on, that just Hitler, you know, Hitler this, Hitler that. They talked about something I hadn't even read in what I thought was the greatest book, A Study in Tyranny, was the greatest book I ever read about Hitler. They said that he got a lot of his ideas from watching Hollywood Westerns. Us and the Native Americans, him and the, you know, he got a lot of ideas from how we conquered the Native Americans, loved Westerns. And then when when they were having dinner there and talking about movies, in the beginning of the book, I went, well, that was right.
Yeah, I mean, the irony.
You can trust the Hitler Channel.
He absolutely adored American movies. He thought they were the best, and he wondered why they couldn't make movies like that in Germany.
Yeah.
And, of course, who's going to tell him you chase everybody out? All the best filmmakers happened to be Jewish, and they left, or they simply were not Nazis. They didn't want to go along with your policies. And this is the shame of the Hollywood system in the 30s, was that the Germans started dictating they would not allow. If you watch movies from 1933 until somewhere in 45, the word Jew and Jewish characters do not exist in Hollywood movies.
That's why when they did Gentleman's Agreement, right? That's why that was such a provocative. Wasn't Gentleman's Agreement?
Yeah, well, that was 47 right? By then.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think what's in the picture called John Ford picture, they were expendable.
Mm.
Came out. Unfortunately, the movie was released a week after the war ended and nobody wanted to see it. And it's probably the best movie made during World War II about the war. But he's got a character in there who's a Jewish soldier in World War II, which was, John Ford was very gutsy that way about the use of black people and other ethnicities. But, it just, you know, and this guy, Georg Gisling, who was the German consul in Los Angeles, he was actually sent scripts to read, and then he would go to screenings. And if he had any protests to make, the studios kowtowed and did it.
Wow.
So, and the irony, of course, is other than Daryl Zanuck, you know, who was the only Gentile studio boss, these guys are all Jews. And they went along with it. And it was only Harry Warner who finally said, enough. Mm. And they made, in 1939, they made Confessions of a Nazi Spy, which features prominently in Hollywood Raj. And you know, Gisling, they were all going nuts. Germany was saying, no, you can't make this movie. You can't, you know, that was the beginning of the end. That was when America finally said, okay, you know, the Jews are back.
It's amazing that they never did in the series, they never did Carry On Nazis. How come they never did?
I don't know.
Carry On Nazis.
You know, I mean, you know, there's a movie. The movie it won the Oscar, I think, in 1938, The Life of Emile Zola.
Mm.
And, you know, we all know Zola was the guy who defended Alfred Dreyfus, you know, who was a victim of French anti-Semitism. And yet in that movie, the word Jew never occurs.
It's not that, for listeners out there, now, you're writing that down. He didn't say Zorba. It's not the Greek. We're talking about someone completely different. Go look it up.
Any of you read books? I don't know.
let's go to Ulrika for a second I would get, cause there's a question here now. All this stuff that we're talking about, this historic stuff, the reality of it and the fact that, this is all very good drama, but it's all the here, there and gone. From a marketing point of view, as the publisher, what's your main, target, to get this to people who might not know about it or do know, you know, what are you looking to be the best audience for a book with this blend of, drama and stuff that is not a video game yet?
Right. Well, I mean, since it has the, you know, it has the two components, you know, it's part history and it's part fictional. So, you know, I think it actually has a very broad market because the story, you know, and it's a fascinating book. I read it. So it's very, you know, a lot of the history I didn't know. And I have to go and Google and I have to check and refresh my World War II history. And, you know, growing up in Sweden, you know, there was a very different version and, you know, there are cultural differences and, you know, right, what you focus on. But I think, you know, this book, it's intriguing to a very broad range of readers. And so, you know, I think, you know, basically 30 years and up. You know, because then, you know, all the, and I've actually, you talked about Generation Z and I've lost track. So I'm just like, I just refer to them as the younger generation because you know, some people, some of them read and some don't, but it's a fascinating book. It's very well written. So it has a very broad target market, but I think the biggest market and, you know, our goal is to get this into a series. Mm-hmm.
This is sort of cart before the horse time, going back to Charles Bennett and this idea that I had. Well, what if it wasn't, what if it wasn't a writer, but it was an actor? And Julian Fellowes, who created Downton Abbey, is a friend, and Holly Palance he introduced me to Holly, and I told Holly the story of Hollywood Raj, and she said, you've got to do this. And so I did a treatment for a TV series. It wasn't a book. It was never meant to be a book originally.
Mm.
And he gave it to Gareth Neame, who was the producer of Downton Abbey. And Gareth's grandfather was Ronald Neame, who directed Poseidon Adventure. And before becoming a director, he was David Lean's cinematographer. And so Gareth always had this, you know, a great link to Hollywood. And also Ronnie Neame's mother, I mean, this is really, you know, obscure. She was one of England's first silent screen stars, and she ended up moving to Glendale, California, somewhere in the 30s, and died on it. So Gareth always felt this kinship, and he kept saying, this is the story of my family. So they optioned the book. So for 2 years, Carnival Films was keen on making a TV series of Hollywood Raj. And then at one point, negotiations fell down. There was a whole argument about what my credit would be.
What? Well, boy, it's always some stupid little thing. Oh, yeah.
I want it created by. They said, well, no, the person who writes the pilot is the creator. I said, but this is my creation. And the negotiations broke down, and I said, you know what? I don't want to get based on an idea by, which to me is like based on a burp after dinner by. So I sat down and took all this information and locked myself in for a couple of months and wrote the book. And that way, no matter what happened, it would be based on the novel by.
Couldn't you get a big check? Couldn't you negotiate a big check for based on an idea by and have your name there? I mean, if they wanted it that badly, can't people negotiate something like the same as if your credit was different?
Well, you know, I think once you're a mega, you know, a best-selling author, which I have never been, then, you know, it's funny. If you ever see the movie Monsieur Verdoux, the chaplain.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And it's based on an idea by Orson Welles. And that was basically to avoid any lawsuit, because I think they went to dinner one night, and Orson Welles suggested something to Charlie Chaplin about that guy who was the famous, the Bluebeard of Paris, who murdered all his wives. And so they just put that credit on to shut Orson up. They wrote him a check for $10,000, and that was it. So he wouldn't bother them.
But he bothered them. But did he?
No, no. He got his $10,000.
Yeah, so cars. Well, but, okay.
This whole thing with credits is always very peculiar.
Well, you had enough going for it for you to sit down and pen the book anyway. So.
Yeah, and I'm making the notes now for the second volume.
Right? The ending is basically, you know, I think Charles has, you know, you have at least another book or two.
Oh, yeah. Basically, the idea was to do one book per year of the war.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah, I was going to ask you next.
There would be five books.
I
don't want to give away the ending of the first book, but the Germans do invade Poland.
Okay, that's... I may be wondering about
or
that.
Is declared.
I was wondering how far they'd go. The tension was building, so the tension was building.
Stop those Germans.
This is Gattolo Chronicles, and we're talking, and time flies as it does, with the publisher and the author of Hollywood Raj, available at Amazon, where everything is available, not just books. Blog.
But you know, it also must be available other places, too, which I've never bothered to explore.
What's available?
There are other platforms.
You know, I know people who went to Brazil and they were looking and seriously were looking for if there are tours to the for the Amazon place like it was Disney. I mean, you know, they went to Brazil. Okay.
Other Amazon?
Yeah, they go, okay. Do they have tours for the Amazon? Is there an Amazon park or something?
It's funny because actually I did a lot of research recently on the Amazon rainforest for another client and some healthcare products from the plants there. And I can say you're pretty big now. It's like there are a lot of snakes, there are a lot of deadly animals, and you don't really want to be there.
Oh, still. But it is an important place, right? Otherwise, what would Sting do in his pre-time?
Oh, no, Bruce. Yeah, right.
But so the book is Hollywood Raj. Now, okay, so here's this book, and it'll work as a novel, obviously. You now have more than an idea based on the book by, or do you? Would you? Has anybody gotten the rights yet? Well, how do you deal with rights, Ulrika?
Well, I mean, basically, we're open to try ideas here. So you know, there's the book now published, and that was, you know, like Charles said, it was. Not to have something based on an idea and based on a book, but also, you know, for us to have it, you know, to have it concrete. And it is a great book. It is a great novel. You know, the market is changing. So people tend to read less and watch more. But, you know, for that market, and we're both kind of old school and picking up a good book and reading. And it really is a page turner. It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, I think I said I finished it in a day. It's just, you know, it's amazing. And it's so good. But, you know, now we have the book, you know, it's on Amazon, it's on a few other places. And, you know, what we would like to see happen now is that someone would option it and you know, basically buy the rights from us and then to do a series and you know, go from there. And you know, Charles has in his brain a lot more, you know, coming from there and, you know, two or three more books. And so... you know, we could possibly, you know, we could possibly do, you know, 30, 40 episodes on the series. So that's really our primary goal. And that's really, you know, our primary focus to come and to find, you know, a strategic, you know, distributor. And not just for Hollywood Rush, but for other projects too. But that's really, you know, Hollywood Rush and Barking Mad, they're, you know, they're the two most proud products of Charles. And, you know, they're like our favorites and his best work. You know, he's got a great library and lots of other, you know, content too. But these two, you know, they're very different. They're very Charles. They're very, you know, they're high quality. And then Hollywood Rush is, it's very historical. And, you know, someone else who would want to write something similar would have to spend, you know, endless hours of research and, you know, combining the history with fictional characters and all of, you know, Charles knowing people and running into people and having this, you know, very, you know, only his knowledge. So it's incredibly unique. It's very, you know, it has a broad market. I mean, anyone, I mean, my 10-year-old son, you know, he liked it and he's interested. And, you know, it really is for everyone. And, you know, it's period. And we keep being told like, oh no, period is out. No one likes period. But, you know, there are a lot of period shows.
Every other thing is period.
Yeah. And, so you know, people really, audiences really like it. And, you know, that comes into budget and, you know, money and how much it's going to cost. But this isn't, you know, wild and crazy budgets to do.
People.
And, you know, all in LA, it's all local. And so that's really our primary target.
Well, we have.
It's, you know, I really wanted to have that book done. So that we kind of, you know, for rights and royalties and et cetera, that there won't be any, you know, arguments or any, you know, any gray areas where we could run into problems in terms of where the idea comes in for what it is. It's Charles' idea. He wrote it and it's there. It's in a book. Buy the book. And now we want to do this.
I just want to need you to explain, as simply as possible, because we have, people who read and write because, obviously, we deal with a lot of pop culture here and talk about a lot of things. Just explain for 1 second as easily as you can, rights, buying the rights. Someone comes to you and says, I love this book and I would like to develop it into whatever they want to do. People don't know a lot about rights. What do you do to option? I mean, you say, oh, my book's optioned. Oh, really? So what did you get? What does that mean? How does that work?
It's, you know, my father had nothing whatsoever to do with the entertainment industry, but he did understand that if you wanted to buy a chunk of land, you took an option on that property, which is where we get the term option the property.
Right.
So basically, let's say, you know, you say, well, it's going to take me a year, possibly 2 years to set up the movie and or TV series. So you put down X amount of money, let's say $X thousand. I like that number. And that gives them the right within 2 years to run around and try and set it up.
So it's a negotiable number. It's a negotiable number. Huh?
Sorry, Frank.
No. I'm saying so I'm going to get this really simple for people. It's a negotiable number for a negotiable amount of time.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Against a purchase price.
Yeah. They buy the right to pretty much do whatever they want with that book or concept for a specified amount of time. And during that time, you know, we couldn't come back and say, oh, well, we found this other deal. It's the option holder. Mm-hmm. You know, can do whatever, but then if they don't do it, the time expires, and then, you know, obviously the money is gone. There are no refunds.
So it's almost rent to own.
Exactly.
Okay.
And what you have to be careful of, if you are the person whose material is being shopped around, when you sign that option agreement, make sure they haven't signed it off to somebody else during that period of time. That they are the sole person, because otherwise you may discover that people that you don't want to be in business with have got the rights to it, and wait, I'm signing the truck.
Boy, things like that have happened too, haven't they?
It's like leasing a house. Yeah. Your title isn't on the deed, but you have the right to access for the house for the amount dictated in the contract, for the amount that you're paying. And during that time, the owners really don't have any rights to it. They can't come into your house. They can't throw you out. They really can't. They can't sell it. They can't do anything.
Terrific.
But you know, they're on the deed.
That's terrific. That is the best explanation, and now I think everybody knows it simply.
And for instance, my friend Michael Laskin, who has appeared on your show.
Yes, Michael.
Several times. 2 years ago, he appeared in a play of mine called Altman's Last Stand.
Yes.
Now, prior to that production, my play was, God help me, under option for 14 years.
Whoa.
To somebody else on two-year increments. And after about the first 4 years, I said, I don't want this guy to option again. But it would the new option would always turn up when the property taxes had to be paid.
Yeah.
X $1,000 in my bank account. Yeah. And so I'd sign my play off again for another 2 years.
It's and amazing.
I just said, you know what? Enough with this guy. If he can't get this together in 14 friggin' years, it's over. Yeah. And then as soon as I got it back, and Michael and I worked on another show, and I realized this man is a brilliant actor. We got the thing set up, and it was produced here 2 years ago.
As a side thing, I want to thank you, because I haven't had a chance, because you've been so busy, and we were supposed to get together when Barking Mad was actively going on. I don't know where you are with that yet, but you could talk about it. But I want to thank you for, I did get connected with Ken Welsh, and we had
a fabulous evening with him. I heard it.
Did you hear? Okay. We had a bunch of fun on that. And, definitely somebody I would sit around and, have drinks with and talk.
Yeah.
Great.
I mean, of course you guys are too.
Next time you get him, give him advance notice and he'll play his clarinet or his trumpet for you.
Oh, I didn't know. He did mention something about
on my birthday, I think it was 2 years ago, he played Happy Birthday for me, and I taped it and put it on Facebook for my birthday.
I had people talking to me after that show. People asked me, like, who the heck is Toot Shore? They said, he said, you know, you're really terrific at this. You remind me of Toot Shore. He said, I was like, really? You know, and I had to talk to people, especially young people.
This, or did somebody else say this?
He said it to me.
What the hell would Ken know about Toot Shore?
I don't know.
Ken Welsh and I have been friends for all my adult life. And I used to go down to New York when I was still a kid in Canada. I used to go to New York a lot working for the newspaper in Toronto. And I used to tell him, you got to go. And he said, I can't go there. I'll be killed. I said, and I realized he'd only ever been in Edmonton. Then he went to Montreal and then, you know, Stratford. And the idea of the United States was terrifying.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he moved to New York and had a huge success there for 10 years and doesn't remember that he was ever afraid of it. But
I told him to be on again, but he's hard to get a hold of because he does a lot of work, which is good. Even at I told him, I said, and then we'll go back to you guys. I don't mean to talk about him while you're here. But I said to him, boy, of all the Sherlock Holmes pieces, I said, you are brilliant to choose Leander the Baskervilles, where Dr. Watson plays the most, has the most exposure than any other, on screen. So I said, it was brilliant, and I love it, and it's on so much. I hope he gets royalties. I don't know. But anyway, I doubt. Okay, let's move back to what is going on with Raj. What else do you want to talk about it? What else do you think people should know?
Just go and buy the damn thing.
I tell you.
Tell your friends, tell your librarian to order the damn thing as well. You know. But, we have so much other stuff going on. The other thing, because of Ulrika's Swedish connection, we have several projects that we're interested in doing. Mm-hmm. And one thing a lot of people don't know, Ulrika has a cousin who is an actor in Sweden, the name may mean something to you, Dolph Lundgren.
It means something. I know it. I don't know who else knows it, but if we spell it, they'll probably search it later.
Well, I mean, Rocky IV, whatever it was, that's when Americans first became aware of Dolph.
Right.
And he then went on to be, you know, in that pantheon of Stallone and Van Damme and all those guys. And, he's a lovely, lovely guy, and there's a story that I'm trying to do as a mini-series. Do you know who the Match King was, Otto?
Match King?
Ian Krieger.
Yeah.
Ian Krieger.
Krug, the Match King. Kruger, this is the guy who Kruger basically...
Sounds, the name Krueger sounds familiar, but...
Caused the Great Depression. He was, you know, he had this whole... He cornered the... He had a monopoly on matches in Europe in the 1920s.
Oh, why does this sound so familiar? Yeah, tell me...
Ivor Krueger. That
was just Ivor Krueger. Ivor Krueger, yeah.
Well, as long ago as 1931, Warner Brothers did a movie called The Match King with Warren William playing a Krueger-type character. And basically, this guy, you know, he was the Bernie Madoff of the 1920s.
Okay.
And most economists or history economists agree that he really was the linchpin to the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fabulous, fabulous story that a modern audience, yeah, it's period, but it's Madoff. It's this whole thing of conning people.
How do you connect it to Dolph? Connect it to Dolph? How does that connect?
To Dolph to play Krueger.
Ah, the Match King. He's a big, strong guy, isn't he? He's a big...
He is. And he started as a model, and then he was always very much into fitness and martial arts. And
he studied engineering.
So he actually studied under my father in mechanical engineering at the Uppsala University. And then when he came to the U.S., he wanted to get into the film industry, and he started as, you know, print model and et cetera. And he got, you know, roles there and there, but he really found his niche to do these, you know, martial arts and you know, physical and athletic roles, you know, that was more presence of, you know, the physical aspect rather than scripts and lines. But he's now kind of reinvented himself, and he's getting more serious roles, or in terms of more like, you know, having, you know, more lines and less moving away from his, you know, for the physical aspect of it. And, you know, and he's wonderful. He's great. He's got great talent. And he's also has, you know, he's very much, you know, involved in, you know, fight against bullying, sex trafficking, and then et cetera. He's a very, very, very sweet, nice, you know, compassionate person. And he had a pretty rough upbringing. So we think, you know, we are looking to involve him in several projects, but especially this one. And great part.
That's what I was asking. Because he'd kind of been typecast here once he made it, right? And, so what else has he done, to play the Match King? I don't know what the Match King looks like, so I don't know why I'm saying that.
Either. It doesn't matter.
Dolph looks very Swedish. I mean, he's very tall. Mm-hmm. He's got that very Viking look, and you know, he's got a strong screen presence, which is, you know, this Ivor Krueger guy. You know, that's what he was, a very kind of strong presence, personality figure. So, you know, we think that, you know, Dolph would be very good. He would handle the role very well.
Where's that story come from, Charles? You have this in mind, or you know a lot about the Match King, or what?
I was on vacation years and years ago in Aruba, and I remember this man came up to me when he found that I was a writer, and he said, "Do you know about the Match King?" And I said, "No." And he started telling me about it, and I thought, "Oh, this is interesting." And the next thing I knew, the guy sent me a 10-page legal agreement he wanted me to sign, in which the dedication was to his wife, and I went, "What the fuck is this?" You know, so I blew it off. You know, I mean, it's public domain. And then if you go on YouTube, there is about 10 minutes of, you know, I loved Warren William, and he was the first Perry Mason back in the 30s, mm-hmm. and he was a wonderful actor, died way too young. And he played a Krueger. You know, it was a fantastic story. And in this book that I found, that was published about 5 years ago, one of the things that would be great for the series itself, he went into a department store and found a 17-year-old girl named Greta Gustafsson, and he was promoting her. He had a film company back then, and he started promoting her as a movie star, and she eventually changed her name to Greta Garbo. Mm. But she was Kruger's mistress.
Mm. Well, there's a match. There's a match made in heaven.
Exactly. There you go.
So what are you saying? This is one of the things you're working on the side. Yeah. You're putting. You putting notes together for this thing, or you?
Yeah. Looking into getting a first time for me to get an option on somebody else's book.
Well,
have the right to this.
Well, just because you get the information, if it's public domain, what do you have to pay?
Well, I don't know. It's just I guess, who knows where this guy got his information from? I suppose I could go and just get a bunch of clippings too. So who knows? Maybe I don't need the rights.
So then,
my lawyer, Frank Catolo, told me to spend money for.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
online.
Good. Ulrika, what?
This is part, the something more in the pipeline, like I used to, like I like to refer to things that, nothing is on paper yet, but it's conceptual. But going a little bit back to, it's like, wrapping up, Hollywood Raj and with that, and, it's something very concrete. We have the book, we have these ideas and I think it can be very rare. We think it can be, very popular and, it's something. It has such a broad target market and, readers can read the book or, a series. And so we really, believe in that. And that we're very excited about that.
What the angle was originally was it was Downton Abbey set in Hollywood.
Right.
All these, Downton Abbey became a phenomenon in America.
Yeah, it's wild, isn't it?
So this is the same thing. An Englishman. His wife is, the biggest interior decorator of Hollywood. He's got three kids who all want to, be stars. So this was all,
So in a way, that in terms of risk and, the business side of it is that, it's a great story. It's a unique story. There's nothing out there even remotely similar. The only kind of comments we've gotten is like, oh, it's period, it's expensive, no one likes it. Well, we know people like it. And, so it's already kind of been test-driven a little bit, but it's like a completely separate and unique thing. So we have a lot of high hopes for that, and we have a lot of negotiations, and, we're very excited about it.
Here's a glimpse into how the business works today, Frank.
You talk about that, I'm going to step away for 2 minutes. All right. I'll be right back. Sorry. Right.
We're counting, Ulrika.
Make sure nothing boils over. But, I have a relationship with Pierce Brosnan, who would be terrific, the star of this. But they don't care who the stars are.
That's what I was going to ask you about, a pack, if you could put together a package. Yeah, tell us. Go ahead. Tell
them. Package. No.
No more.
The magic word in television today is showrunner. Who is the showrunner?
Right.
And if you're a showrunner, you can have anything you want if you're a successful one. That means that you created a TV series that's already run for 4, 5, 6 years, like this woman, Shonda Rhimes. She's now the biggest female showrunner in the business. Oh, you want to do a show about black aliens from Venus? Go ahead.
Mm.
Here's a guarantee, 13 episodes, because you're magic. We just finished watching on Amazon Prime. I don't know if you were aware of a series 2 years ago called Brain Dead.
No, I have not been keeping up with those. There's so many of them. No, I haven't.
Well, Robert and Michelle King, mm-hmm. who created The Good Wife and then spun it off into The Good Fight, they're gods at CBS. So they came up with this really bizarre thing called Brain Dead, which we found fascinating. But we also realized there's no way anyone was going to watch this past the first season. Uh-huh. It made David Lynch accessible, But they are, because they ran that show, and it was a huge rating success with 5 or 6 seasons with The Good Wife. People want to be in business with them. So it really doesn't matter who stars in your series. The networks want to know who's going to run that show, who's got a track record. And so, we have been running around trying to find, when the Downton Abbey people, their problem was different because they were already money showrunners because of Downton Abbey. So they had no problem, but who was going to write the pilot? And there's only X number of people on the list. Mm. And the problem was these people are booked and they couldn't get anyone immediately to write the script.
How do you become a showrunner, though? I mean, right off the bat.
Okay, how do you become a showrunner? Once upon a time, there's a TV series called MASH.
Yeah.
So there was writer's room, and there were probably 10 people in that room.
Yeah.
And several of those people, because they were associated with MASH, then went on to create other television series and became showrunners. You usually, the progression to showrunner is writing a successful TV series.
So, wait, MASH was written by a whole bunch of people here and there. And they've been farmed out. I know someone who did a script. They farmed out scripts too. Gelbert did.
Yeah.
Well, then
that's how you get to be a showrunner. Or you come up with an idea and you're taken under the wing of, you know, like the guy who did Magnum PI, you know.
Okay.
Or Steve, he's dead now. Steve? Rockford Files.
Yeah, I forgot his name.
Steve Cannell. So he had proteges, and his proteges then went on to become showrunners.
Mm. It's amazing how many shows there are. I know they don't all last, but there's just so many of them that aren't network related. Of course, networks own some of the cable places, but you know they only show up on cable. And this Amazon Prime thing I've heard about, but I don't have it. But how does HBO has its own production company? Does HBO have its own showrunners, or does it go to other people to distribute, or are they looking for things? What's the hierarchy of this?
Well, David Milch, you know, who is now, like, he doesn't exist anymore, but David Milch had NYPD Blue, which was a great success. He was offered a deal with HBO and came up with Deadwood, which it seemed was a huge success for a number of years, and suddenly they just pulled the plug on him after 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and nobody, you know, all the actors, because I had a lot of friends on that show, they discovered they weren't working, there was no explanation. They just said, we're not going to do it anymore.
Mm.
Now, whether it was too expensive because it was a Western and the horses, I don't know.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
Right.
And then Milch basically, you know, he still had a deal with them to keep coming up with shows, and they became more and more bizarre, and nobody wanted to know. But no, they don't have in-house. What they may have is an associate producer, an executive producer who represents the network, who's there on set. You know, as the studios always had later on in the 60s and 70s, right. There'd be somebody there from the head office who was basically a spy to make sure that, you know, you weren't, the lunch was 1 hour, no 90-minute lunch here, and why do you need those napkins, et cetera, you know, that sort of thing.
Probably all for a good reason.
But today, you know, it's the independent world.
Yeah. So did you have a plan with any of these? People, you know, to kind of channel the stuff through this one to that one to this one to that one?
Well, you know, what we're looking for, obviously, is to, once we get the showrunner for Hollywood Raj and is successful, then we can be the showrunners on something else.
Right,
once
so you're
associated with a hit, then you can make the leap into, you know,
yeah, that's a catch-22, though, isn't it, in a sense?
Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah. But that also goes in a little bit. So that's the one side, you know, with the Hollywood Rush, and, you know, that, you know, we were exploring, you know, the possibility of, you know, it's a little bit different, you know, if we could, you know, basically write our own script for it and then do what we did with Barking Mad. But we decided it's just not possible. It really does require a lot more. But going to Barking Mad, you know, that really is very, you know, that's pioneering in, you know, basically filming, doing a feature film. You know, Charles wrote it and then filmed it on an iPad. So it was him and I, and then the actors. And, you know, when needed, we called in a few people here and there. And basically, you know, so this also actually is a much bigger concept, because this is now, you know, Food Dog Films. I mean, there are different, you know, projects, and each project is going to be treated a little bit differently, but there's one, you know, bucket. I like buckets. So there's one bucket that really is focused on this concept that, okay, so what happened, you know, fast foray in the film industry, you know, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, you know, actors would go to the studios. It was just like any employment. You go there and you make, you know, whatever, 30 movies a year and you go home. And then it went from, you know, and then that was abused, and then the unions came in, And then people started, you know, becoming independent contractors, and you basically have to go out and get, you know, each film is its own project. And then what happened? It just went completely crazy. So you have these people who make nothing. And then you have this other category of people who make, you know, talent to make $1 million per episode. And, you know, both scenarios are insane. Yeah. And so, but that's kind of where we're at right now. And everything has changed. You know, the players have changed. People don't go to the movies the same they do. Right. We have Netflix, Amazon, Hulu. We have the streaming.
Right.
You know, everything has completely changed. And, you know, still these crazy budget movies are made, and, you know, they spend $100 million and, you know, they make 200.
On lunch.
Yeah, and they pay 200 at the box office, but they still don't make any money. So that's the environment Charles was in 2 years ago when he came up with the At Will at Large concept. So he got an iPad, started filming, and he put the episodes on YouTube. So he did that for about a year. And then along came Ulrika and Love Financial, and I said, well, this is all fine and great. This is wonderful. We know the concept worked. And, you know, it was very fascinating to me. And then, you know, the YouTube and, you know, the episodes, they got a lot of hits. They got a lot of good feedback. So I said, okay, great. Now we know it works. The iPad works. So let's not do that free anymore. Let's stop it and have like a grand finale on YouTube. Take it off. And then, you know, revamp it for somewhere else, which is what we did. So we decided that it's better to just do a feature with this. And so now, you know, a year later, we have this wonderful feature film with, you know, great cast, great acting. And basically, you know, again, going back to Food Dog Films reinvented, you know, core competency and vision is to do, you know, low budget, no budget, even like bullfingering, like running around. It's like, why ask, why pay for, you know, this, you know, $10,000 to film in the restaurant when we can, you know, shoot outside for 2 minutes, or ask the owner, hey, can we just shoot in here? We'll advertise it for you. We'll have a great establishment shot. And are you happy with that? And the response was just absolutely overwhelming. People are like, oh, of course you can. Like, that's great. And so that's where we're at. So, you know, we have this phenomenal movie with a, you know, basically it's a great script, great writing, and great acting. And it might seem like, well, what else would it be? But it's shocking, you know, with all the CGI and the car crashes and buildings being blown up and everything but good writing and good acting. You know what I mean? If you throw enough money at something, you know, not in my opinion, but, you know, they're like, then it's got to be good. Blow up another car or tear this building down. And so it's insane. And so this, you know, Food Dog Films now is like really like just good writing, good acting. And that's, you know, what we think the audience wants. And that is what the audience wants. And that's what it used to be. It's like, you know, just, you know, immerse yourself in the movie for an hour and a half, you know, rather than, you know, all these crazy, you know, police chases and people being shot up or decapitated and all this gross stuff. So that really, you know, Barking Mad is the first project in Food Dog Films' new strategy and new concept of just really going back to the fundamentals. And it's simple. And it's like, I'm always like, simple, easy, and like three ingredients, three concepts, you know, don't overwhelm people. And even myself. But so that really, so that's where we're at now with this movie. And it's gotten a lot of good feedback, a lot of attention. And so now that's really when we're looking for a strategic distribution partner who believes in the same concept. And, you know, we're looking a lot in Sweden because there are some Swedish actors. And, you know, this script and this mood, kind of the film noir, but with a comedy twist.
Uh-huh.
It's very Scandinavian. It's, I mean, it's very North European. And, you know, but, you know, anyone, you know, in anywhere, and, you know, so, but really with this new concept and also whomever buys it can, it's like a win-win. And that's another thing. It's like, you make it affordable, you can sell it affordable. You know, we're not sitting here where we have to recover, you know, these astronomical costs for investors who, you know, have it in a hedge fund or whatever.
Right.
It's very simple. It's very easy. It's a win-win. Anyone involved in our project, it's an easy win-win. I mean, it's not $200 million, But it's, you know, it's good money and it's good work and it's a good product, you know, project. And everyone can feel proud and happy and like they accomplished something when they walk away. And, you know, so it's clean and simple and actually very Swedish. It's that Swedish logic.
and you have to count on the royalties you will get from making Bowfinger a verb.
Yeah. You know what? You're like the fifth person.
Are you
going to
get? Is that? Did you just come up with that, or did you hear someone else? Because perhaps you can get some royalties on that.
Well, it's
sell it to Oxford.
We made it the Bowfingering.
I agree.
You know,
when I wrote my first novel 106 years ago, I would take actors' names, last names, and use them as verbs about this guy Fairbanks'd his way into the restaurant. And it was perfect. You know,
I got Flynn'd. But, you know, I agree with you, and I'm still wonder, because there is such a need for product, but I still wonder, which means that you have a bigger chance that even though there might be more product, there is still more of a need for product. But I wonder how some movies get made at all. I see little movies. We'll call these little movies regardless, okay? Know what you're talking about, which is, you know, acting situations, nothing's blowing up and nobody is those superheroes. And I wonder where does this money come from? You read the names of the producers? Have you ever seen it before? How does this stuff get done?
That's the million, that's the billion dollar question.
Is it?
We ask ourselves that every day. It's shocking.
In Canada, you know, I knew all about the tax shelter business. So there are all these god awful movies that were made for 20 years because of this crazy tax shelter thing, right, where basically you didn't even have to put the producer would get the tax credit money, but the people who signed the thing didn't have to put any money down. And then for years, they'd be chased by the government saying, where's the money you promised us? We put up the money for the movie. So that's a different racket. But there must be some kind of tax situation in this country.
But then also this goes back to, and so, you know, my background has been, you know, investment banking, finance analysis and all that, where it's, you know, technical. 2 + 2 = 4, and, you know, it's not 4.01, it's not 3.99, it's 4. But, you know, film and creative, it's not that. I mean, good, you know, is a movie, when you say you saw a movie, is it good or bad? Well, there is no answer, because I might think it's good, you might think it's bad, but, you know, there isn't the formula. And so that's why it becomes very complicated to measure. You know, there's very difficult, or it's actually impossible to quantify or qualify. The only way to really qualify or quantify is the box office, but by then it's like too late to change anything. Yeah. But that goes again back into, you know, going into it. Like anything you buy, I mean, anything you do, you know, I worked a lot with real estate. So real estate is a great analogy. You know, I lived in Houston for many years, and you can buy buildings that are really cheap. Well, then you can sell them cheap because, you know, you don't have that money, too much money, right, that you have to recoup. Here in LA, it's opposite. Here people buy expensive, but then they have to wait for it to make money to be able to sell and make a profit. And, you know, the same thing is with movies. The more you spend, the more you have to recoup, and right, the higher the risk. And then, you know, there can be this group of people, and, you know, you tend to collaborate with people or yay-sayers and like it, or, you know, it's like these stars, and it's like all, you know, they're surrounded by people and they can't possibly say no. It's like, you know, the emperor's new clothes. It's like, oh, no, you're fine, you're fine. And then like $300 million later, you know, they get a big no from the audience. So it's just it's difficult. I mean, you can't, it's not art. I mean, anything, there is no right or wrong, which goes back to my kind of like wrapping up things, you know, with Food Dog Film and the new vision and the new concept. And that is, you know, Charles and I are very good partners with this because he is 100,000% creative, and he's an absolute genius in content and writing and coming up with things and really, you know, making a project out of it. I'm 1,000% technical and finance and money, mm-hmm, but we both understand each other's profession. And so combining creative talent with finance and numbers to be able to come up with a reasonable and feasible project that makes sense It's absolutely critical for survival. And that is exactly what has not happened the last 20 years in the movie-making industry. Because, you know, there's been absolute disasters. And, you know, some hits are hits, but were they really hits because they were planned and managed to be hits? In my opinion, no. They, you know, it just happened. But it goes back to, for the finance people, to be able to quantify and qualify something that isn't quantifiable or qualifiable. And that's really the trick. And that's where Foodog Film has a very competitive advantage. And, you know, we're very good at doing that because I can pick the ideas that Charles have and say, I love it. That's great. But no, that's not going to go. We do that later. And, you know, when we have a little war chest, but for now, the low hanging fruit, then these are the low hanging fruits because this is what I see the numbers looking like in terms of popularity and selling and, you know, audience and marketing and promotion and, you know, all of that good stuff.
Well, you got really,
that's really the new Foodog Films here. And that's the vision and strategy we're going with. And we have, you know, three buckets of projects and Barking Mad is in bucket A. And that is this low budget, no budget bullfringering, like, easy to get out. Win-win for everyone.
That's what was keeping you really busy. When I had emailed you and said, hey, you know, when you get done with, or you were doing Barking Mad, I guess, that's what you were doing during that time.
Right.
You were real busy, probably writing four books at the same time and a couple of plays. Sure. But
right.
Still. And so, but where's Barking Mad? It's in the can now, right? I mean, it's there.
Yeah, well, we've just literally about a half an hour before we started speaking with you, the sound mix is almost finished. And, my friend Alan Gasmer, who represented me on, Hollywood Raj, is very keen to, you know, get out there with that. Cause there's all kinds of platforms for it once it's done, you know, whether it be Hulu or Netflix. I mean, I would still love to four wall it perhaps in a small theater for a week so that it was a feature film that actually got out.
Right.
Escaped, as they say. But I want to come back to your thing, you know, about these little movies that we end up seeing on Netflix and whatever and go, this, where did the, you know, okay, fine. So they sold it to Netflix or to Hulu, but where did that money come from for a nuns? And we know the studios, except for Fox that has that Searchlight that does quote artsy movies.
Right.
I don't know. Remember that movie Mistress with Robert De Niro about 20 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where Robert Woolard wanted to make this movie and he was interviewed by all these different guys who had girlfriends who wanted to be in the movie. And that's where the money came from. I don't know. I don't know whether there's some funny money that's somewhere in Europe that then has to be moved somewhere. I directed a musical in London many years ago. And I know where that money came from, and it didn't come from any place normal. You know, there was some money that had to disappear from some account. So they put it into this music.
It's like Bialystok and Bloom.
Exactly. Well, that was little old lady life.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it wasn't far from the, you know, the actual understanding.
No, and so I think there are still those dentists that want to be associated.
Well, it's got to be. You know, I was thinking that the other day, I watched, Lord knows what movie, whatever it was, or started to watch it, but I'm watching the credits, and I'm going, and you see, produced by, executive produced by, also produced by, and I'm going, I've never seen these names before. I've got to... When I look these names up, are they all on the internet, on the database? If one, I mean, are all these producers, everybody who got their name in a credit, who were producers and put up money? Where, who are all these people?
Well, if you go on IMDb now and look at, you know, movies in the last 5 years, and you know, and then you drop the drop down when it says producer, the average now is anywhere from 20 to 32.
That's crazy.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Now, the Academy has made it clear that no more than 7 people can go up to get the Oscar.
Ah.
So there's a huge fight over that. You know.
Oh, the stamping.
That movie, remember Crash?
Oh, yeah.
That had 17 people, but they only had 4 people go up on stage.
That's the least of the problem.
Well, as opposed, now, have you ever watched it? I don't watch it anymore, the Tony Awards. But when you watch the Tony Awards, and whoever wins for either best play or best musical half the audience is on the stage.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, plays, that's well, another.
But the theater, everybody's a producer. They, you know, yes, you can have 10,000, but I have to have my name as a producer. Yeah. Gone are the days of the angels, the anonymous angels. Everybody wants to get into the act.
Well, there should be a book, like there used to be a book for, you know, radio markets. I forgot the name of it. You know, where you'd go and find the demographics. There should be a book of producers. Shouldn't there be a reference or some kind of database you could go to where they have names and addresses and things that, you know, people who are interested? There's got to be a ton of these people. There's got to be a huge volume. No, huh? Don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
I remember years ago, I had an uncle who was an accountant in Canada and, you know, looking to get investment for a film. And he said, there's still a lot of virgins out there.
Yeah. Wow. It's,
would always be people, you know, who live boring lives, who have money in the bank, who want to get near the show business.
Yeah, see their name on. Well, these must be the people who are keeping some of this stuff alive because a lot of it is being sold because you could watch, stars, you know, and you see some names because, you know, people need work too, you know, actors and actresses need work. And they do this stuff, I guess, for less. A lot of them do it for less, right? I don't even know what's less, you know?
Once you get past the first 20 names.
Yeah.
Then you can get everyone for scale plus 10. Plus 10, by the way, is the agent's commission.
So
it's unbelievable who you can get to work for you now. And they have name value on your poster or on the TV thing.
Well, let's get some of those people on the show. Maybe we can get them to...
call Tom Sizemore, will you? Here's a movie I want to see. Tom Sizemore and Michael Madsen in.
Michael Madsen. Well, that's okay.
I could never tell which one was which. I just know they both broke up, you know, tables and people.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay. I know that. I have a long line of that in my family. But anyway, every time you guys are on, and I really appreciate the fact that you're looking at me. You can't see me, but you look right in my eyes. I love this. You know, for me, it's great.
I can see you.
The people don't know it, but I appreciate it. And let's see what we could do, with, Eureka and you and the book and other people that you know that are always great, that you bring on that we could talk to, and do this again. Cause I'm sorry to say we've run out of time.
No way. No way.
But if you say the secret word, I'll give you another 5 minutes. No. Tell everyone, once again, before we leave them here at an undisclosed location somewhere in the cyber world, Eureka and Charles Dennis, we're Hollywood Raj, Amazon, and anywhere else. I just Google it, and Google Charles, and Foo Dog has its own site too. Foo Dog. And you get the whole spiel at it. And a lot of you people who listen to this show know of this anyway. The show will, of course, rerun. You're listening to the live. If you're listening to the live stream, so rerun on any number of stations, including twice a day in Montreal at True Talk Radio. So you can hear that.
But what about in Sweden?
I don't know. We were big in England for a while. We had a couple of English stations and stuff. I don't know. Really? And then Japan was, when we started, the Japanese were the first people to find us. They're the only people who could afford the equipment, I think. They were making it in their home and catching it. Anyway, come back, both of you, and bring
people. We will.
Bring people.
Spending this hour and a half.
And Ulrika will be writing to you, Frank.
It's okay. Good. And bring, show us. Show me, at least, when you come back, show food again, like you did that day.
I
love that. Right.
Yeah.
Next time, we'll bring you Kim Delgado again, because he'll talk nonstop.
That's another show we're planning.
I know.
We'll have you back for that.
I'm losing some weight, so I like to look at the stuff, you know, because I'm done with that. I thank both of you. And
virtual food.
We will do, exactly. And we'll do everything we can every week to remind everybody. And when I remind them of my books, I remind them of yours, and we'll move on and see what we can do.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure always.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful evening and weekend.
Same here. You guys too. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Ciao.
All right. Thank you.
There they go. They were here. Now they're gone. Wonderful, wonderful talk. Always talking to them. There's always great stuff, you know? I didn't know about showrunners. I should know about this stuff. Oh, boy. That click, that it's always, it, oops, excuse me. I told you I have the return here. I call it a return. I have the boom mic, and I just went boom with a boom mic. My name is Frank Cotolo. Man's name adorns the title of the show. This is Cotolo Chronicles. We made it. Regardless of the problems with technical stuff, we are gone through it again, and here we go into the theme is what we're going to do. And the next week, I don't know, but we never know. What's going to happen? Watch the blog. Get to me at Facebook, fcotolo@yahoo.com. If you want to tell me about other shows you know about or topics, and we can pick up some of those shows from the past and incorporate them into these shows. And boy, before you know it, we got a whole show going. And in the meantime, in between time, do go buy the book, Hollywood Raj, R-A-J, Charles Dennis, Noreika, and the publisher. And you get that there and get my books also there and at blurb.com and lulu.com. You never know when these places are just going to go out of business. You know, you don't know. So there you go. Good night, Mrs. Ernstwhile, wherever you may be located. We shall return one way or another, week after week. Keep you posted. We've done a lot of talking again, so... And I didn't do it all, though. We had those wonderful talkers, didn't we? Well, it's enough of that. It's not over until the fat lady suffocates. So here we go. I've had enough. You've had enough. And I have nothing more to say.